Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchik. On today's show, we'll feature two monologues about two media issues, a Chicago ordinance involving Chicago cable public access, and a federal law about low-power FM radio. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
There was a time not so long ago when the radio in Nashville would sound radically different than in Seattle. But when the 1996 Telecommunications Act opened the door for companies to buy up as many radio stations as they could nationwide, commercial radio behemoths like Clear Channel came to dominate the airwaves, and the distinct sounds of local communities faded from the dial. That could be changing. The Local Community Radio Act, just introduced in Congress by Representatives Mike Doyle of Pennsylvania and Lee Terry of Nebraska, would dramatically alter the radio landscape. This single piece of legislation would open up the public airwaves to hundreds, if not thousands, of new, small, non-commercial radio stations. Sean Campbell of the Chicago Independent Radio Project, a group that has been organizing for a low-power FM station since August of 2007, believes local radio is essential to help people understand what's really happening in their communities.
The current economy has absolutely decimated local media. This year, Chicago faces the possible loss of one or even both of its daily newspapers. Localism has been disappearing in commercial radio for years, and now even public radio stations have been hit hard by the recession, eliminating local programs and news in favor of network programming. Community radio absolutely can help fill these holes.
Low-power FM stations were first authorized in 2000, but at the last minute, under pressure from commercial broadcasters who claimed the small stations would interfere with their signals, Congress limited the new community stations to rural areas. A taxpayer-funded $2 million engineering study by the FCC later found the interference claims to be false. To find out more about the Local Community Radio Act, House Bill 1147, visit freepress.net/LPFM.
All of the reporters who were in the newsroom were gathered around the news desk, and two of the top people from corporate, from Scripps, were there. And immediately, when you see that scene, given what's happening to journalism across the country, they're not there to tell you good news.
It's been a bad couple of weeks for newspapers. Philadelphia Media Holdings, publisher of the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News, filed for bankruptcy. So did the Journal Register Company, publisher of the New Haven Register and 19 other dailies. The companies are reeling from crushing corporate debt, from acquisitions made during boom times that have now gone bust. They joined Tribune Company and the Star Tribune of Minneapolis, which are already in bankruptcy protection. Many papers are now teetering on the brink of closure. The San Francisco Chronicle, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the Miami Herald, and the Detroit News are all on the ropes. But the most devastating blow came last week to the 150-year-old Rocky Mountain News owned by E.W. Scripps. Matthew Roberts was a multimedia producer at the Rocky. He made a 21-minute video about the closing of the paper. He said the announcement in December that the paper was up for sale was a blow to the entire newsroom.
I think everyone was under the impression that we were doing things well, we were doing things correctly, we were very progressive and very proactive in embracing the digital newspaper age. So nobody was expecting it.
Robert says that part of the problem was the joint operating agreement that the Rocky had with their competition, the Denver Post, which is owned by Media News Group. Congress passed a law in the 1970s that allowed struggling papers to share operating resources while maintaining separate newsrooms. But changes to business models are difficult with such arrangements, and when the Internet wiped out much of the classified advertising revenues, the papers weren't nimble enough to adjust.
The Rocky Mountain News didn't have control of their own advertising. And I think as such, we lost out on a number of advertising opportunities.
Jason Salzman, president of Effect Communications and founder of the True Spin Conference, was one of two media critics for The Rocky. He says EW Scripps violated the public trust by pulling the plug on the paper.
Over the years, they made lots and lots of money in Denver. They had been operating here for about 100 years. The Rocky had been open for 150, and they've made millions and millions of dollars. The newspaper industry historically has been very lucrative. For them to just pull out like that in the course of a few months is just outrageous.
If you look at the overall financial state of Scripps versus Median News Group, Median News Group, they're in a lot worse shape than Scripps is, but Scripps is subject to their shareholders. Median News Group is not, and that gives Median News Group a little bit more freedom to wait this out, to try some different things. I can only imagine that Scripps has been under an awful lot of pressure from their shareholders.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Barack Obama, who was never an anti-war candidate, reveals himself as a pro-war president who would rather mangle the English language than tell the truth. Obama and his generals are agreed that the U.S. should leave about 50,000 U.S. troops in Iraq after the targeted withdrawal of so-called combat troops by the end of August 2010. So what are we supposed to call these 50,000 American military personnel if they are not combat troops? Obama wants us to call them a transition force. Presumably, they will transition to death anyone that opposes them. Obama thinks that by changing the nomenclature, he can announce mission accomplished, declare peace, and then keep the war going indefinitely. That's why the Joint Chiefs of Staff are happy. John McCain is happy. But Democratic congressional leadership is anything but happy. With the turn of a phrase, President Obama has placed himself to the right of his own party and stabbed all of his wishful anti-war supporters in the back. When it comes to torturing the language, Obama is more shameless than Vietnam-era presidents, who persisted in calling U.S. troops fighting in that country advisors until the term became laughable. As much as they would like to, the American generals in Iraq and their commander-in-chief can't call the 50,000 soldiers and Marines that are to remain behind advisors. There are simply too many of them, and they will continue to be organized for combat at the drop of a hat. Instead, the name game describes the troops as a transition force, as opposed to a combat force. Which doesn't mean they won't be in combat. On the contrary, armed Americans in full battle gear will be roaming around looking for targets and fighting alongside the Iraqi military. It will look and sound just like combat. People on both sides and civilians will be killed just like in combat. But it will not be combat because President Obama says the mission is transition. After August 2010, U.S. soldiers and Marines in Iraq will be engaged in transitioning, not combat. Obama is worried that many people may not be sophisticated enough to understand the fine distinction between combat soldiering and transitioning. Let me say this as plainly as I can, Obama told Marines at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina last weekend. By August 31st, 2010, Obama said with a straight face, our combat mission in Iraq will end. Why? Because Obama chooses not to call it combat. Obama has spoken. Semantics equals reality. Which makes you wonder, what kind of semantic trick was Obama playing when he told the joint session of Congress, I can stand here tonight and say without exception or equivocation that the United States of America does not torture. If methodically killing people is not combat, then maybe the methodical infliction of physical and emotional pain isn't always torture. Maybe torture, like combat, is in the eye of the beholder, or more to the point, the presidential definer, the semanticist-in-chief. Apparently, when Barack Obama promised change, he meant a change in definitions. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
It's the sixth anniversary of the Iraq War, and the Chicago movement against the war has extended to include immigrant rights, economic rights, and civil rights for free speech. Join the Chicago Anti-War and Immigrant Rights Coalition for a rally and march on Saturday, March 14th at 12 noon at Marshall Boulevard and Cermak Road, two blocks from the California stop on the CTA Pink Line. For more information, visit chicagomassaction.org or call 773-209-1187. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature two monologues about two media issues, a Chicago ordinance involving Chicago cable public access, and a federal law about low-power FM radio. The following monologues were recorded on Saturday, March 7, 2009. Chicago Access Network Television, CAN-TV, the fleet of public access cable television channels, five channels that service Chicago area cable subscribers and have since the 1980s, service five channels and provide a lot of diverse programming that you don't see anywhere else on television. They include regularly produced shows from a labor's perspective, labor beat, from an independent perspective of politics like Chicago Independent Television. A disclaimer, I helped to produce the show. The regular show Democracy Now! News and a politics show that airs every weekday. Call-in shows by a host of community groups across Chicago servicing all kinds of various issues. From politics to health to daily living to you name it, to informative programs through Community Partners, Community Forum series, regular programming that's not in English that you see on CAN-TV, plus also various shows on things like music and culture and all sorts of affairs. CAN-TV has been able to do this with a comparatively meager budget. It's the victim of an outdated funding structure that's affected the funding capabilities of CAN-TV for years now. The future stability is at risk even. The idea behind the funding structure is CAN-TV basically gets more money based on the number, if there are more cable companies to be able to provide funding. However, in this era of media concentration, particularly in cable companies, this is a particularly acute problem, certainly in Chicago, where we're down to just three companies that service cable within the city limits of Chicago: Comcast, RCN, and Wide Open West. So efforts are underway to try to help to maintain the stability of CAN-TV for the future. There's good news. There has been an ordinance to actually help to provide some of this funding that's before the city council, referred to as the Stone-Burke Ordinance, a reference to two city aldermen who are sponsoring the vote, who are sponsoring the legislation. One is Edmund Burke of the 14th Ward, who's the chair of the City Finance Committee, and Bernard Stone of the 50th Ward, longtime supporter of CAN-TV and actually an original member of the first City Cable Commission. CAN-TV would really need this ordinance, a particular funding structure which would help to basically amend city law regarding cable television in light of a state video franchise law that the state of Illinois passed about 2 years ago. What would happen here is that there would be a funding stream that would actually be provided from the state of Illinois, rather than the city. 1% funding stream that would actually be provided to CAN-TV for public educational and government channels, PEG as it's called. And it would be directed from existing cable providers that actually service on the statewide franchise basis. And this is actually consistent with what CAN-TV has had in the first 15 years of cable's franchises that occurred in Chicago and would help tremendously to go a long way to providing a funding resource for CAN-TV. But if it doesn't pass, calamities would befall KNTV as far as its future viability is concerned. It would probably lose, even in 2009, perhaps a quarter of its current budget, almost certainly if we forced to cut staff, cut services, and perhaps even cut some of the programming, because it wouldn't have the staff or services or resources to maintain that. And given the fact that cable revenues are growing at maybe 5% or 7% per year, there's certainly money there that can be devoted. Should be more in the city level, but here we're talking about affecting laws at the state level. This particular ordinance that we're talking about actually did come up for consideration back in 2008. In fact, on Halloween, no, October 31st, there were about 100 KNTV staff and supporters who actually filled a city hall conference on Halloween, October 31st, 2008. And again, another point of clarification and disclosure, I was one of those supporters. At that hearing on October 31st, there was a hearing that actually addressed a number of issues. One of them, item number 6 on the meeting agenda with 34 listed items, was this particular KNTV funding ordinance, the Burke-Stone Ordinance, as it's called. It was listed as the 6th item, but for reasons that never were really revealed, it was basically just postponed to the very end. They basically, when they got to item number 6, they basically just moved it to item 34, and it wasn't clear exactly why that was the case. So that meant that KNTV supporters had to sit for 4.5 hours at this meeting without a break, and the meeting actually never came to a vote. This ordinance never actually did come to a vote. The reason being because with a meeting so long, the meeting recorder, the person who has to actually transcribe the what goes on at the meeting, couldn't work by city law, and there wasn't a replacement recorder who was available. And so by law, they actually had to suspend the meeting before they could bring it to a vote. What wound up happening is that the ordinance was brought up to a vote. Barbara Popovich, who is the executive director of KNTV, did testify per the request of the city and actually supported the ordinance and answered questions that various committee members did support. There seemed to be warm support from committee members on behalf of KNTV and behalf of this proposed ordinance. They even kind of joked to offer their own respective wards for a new permanent home for KNTV. KNTV actually has facilities in Greektown that they actually rent out, but there's been talk about possibly setting up a permanent home for KNTV that they actually own themselves. So they were kind of joking about this. Popovich testified. It seemed like there was strong support. And then Norma Reyes, who is the Commissioner of Consumer Services, actually testified against the ordinance, saying that the channels that the city of Chicago actually own, a small number of channels that seem to be not as good, at least when I've watched them in the rare instances that I've watched them, and they're not as participatory. It seems like that they tend to be more of promoting various city services, but there's not a whole lot of a participatory element to them, unlike in KNTV. In KNTV, you can get training, you can get airtime, you can have a show if you want. In fact, a great many people do. Very hard, since so many people do want shows, and the city channels that are at least in my opinion don't seem to offer that. Norma Reyes actually testified against this ordinance, saying that that funding stream should be divided 50-50 between KNTV and the city, and then they're saying that the city's channels should fall under PEG classification relevant to the ordinance. But committee members and aldermen were publicly skeptical of this. They were questioning the claim that the city should already get a 5% collection of a fee in addition to this 0.5% that they're actually asking for. So there's a lot more money, proportionally speaking, for these channels that aren't very good, whereas KNTV is able to do a lot more and a lot better programming with less money. Which has been steadily disappearing, so it seems like they would call for a greater funding ordinance. In fact, actually, one alderman, Walter Burnett of the 24th Ward, actually testified against the ordinance specifically because he himself has a show on KNTV and doesn't have a show in the city's channels, and actually wound up seeing people who applaud on his behalf. So we've got this ordinance It never came up for a vote. It will come up for a vote, at least so we think, on March 16, 2009. If the ordinance passes, we could stand to see reliable funding and to help to fill in the funding gap that that KNTV has been suffering from for years now. If it fails, we could see a funding cut, and especially given the amount of resources and especially given these precarious economic times where television stations are reeling left and right, particularly broadcast. Broadcast television has, in the last 6 months or so, certainly since the banking collapse in mid-2008, has seen a tremendous shortfall with regards to funding. They're not being able to sell very many ads, comparatively speaking. So much so that there's been talk in February 2009 that some broadcast channels may actually abandon their network affiliation and become cable channels. To help to fill in their funding shortfall. And their future viability may be in question here. But their quality of programming is far dwarfed by that, by something like KNTV, which only reaches cable channels, cable subscribers in the city of Chicago. There's a tremendous number of those households and comprise maybe two-thirds of all households in the city of Chicago that get television, maybe two-thirds of all TV viewers in Chicago subscribe to cable and thus get KNTV as part of that package. And given the fact that broadcast television is on pretty shaky grounds and may change very radically very soon, that's all the more importance for this, for KNTV, and particularly for this funding ordinance. For folks who are interested in the hearing and would want to take part in it, the meeting will be taking place at City Hall at 10 a.m. on March 16th. The address is 121 North LaSalle Street at the second floor in the City Council Chambers. Again, 10 a.m. March 16th, City Hall, 121 North LaSalle Street in the second floor in the City Council Chambers. Also, if you happen to live in the city of Chicago, you're encouraged to contact your representative on the city council, your alderman, to urge a yes vote for the Stone-Burke KNTV ordinance. There are plenty of ways to be able to get contact information. One way is to contact KNTV directly. They'll be more than happy to help. Their phone number is 312-738-1400, 312-738-1400. They're actually also providing bus transportation from KNTV to City Hall. And if folks are interested with that, you can also contact KNTV at 312-738-1400 or online at kntv.org. The matter is critical, and it's also critical not just for this particular media resource, but for the host of political movements and political resources and communities that rely on KNTV as a viable option. And so the fight extends in this particular ordinance has greater importance as a result of that. So get involved, and we'll see what happens on March 16th. On this week's episode of Media Minutes, we heard excerpts and a report about the Local Community Radio Act. The bill is H.R. 1147 for folks who would be interested in it, which would basically remove, as let me quote from DIYmedia.net, doityourselfmedia.net, DIYmedia.net, an excellent website that talks about all kinds of media-related issues. The main point of this bill, the Local Community Radio Act, is to remove the overly strict channel separation rules that are applied to low-power FM radio stations. This last-minute change to the FCC's rules by a congressional fiat in 2001 lowered the number of potential LPFM stations in the United States from possibly several thousand to just under 1,000, and almost none of those stations are located within major metropolitan areas, which are where the number majority of U.S. citizens and radio listeners live. While there is cause for optimism with regards to this particular bill, and no doubt there's going to be a serious push among community radio and media activists from across the United States, and particularly here in Chicago, with a project like the Chicago Independent Radio Project being among the leaders in this initiative to win low-power FM radio stations in cities. the DIYmedia.net calls for, I guess, a little bit of a reality check, as they're calling it. They say, and I'm quoting again from the website, "Removing this restriction does not do much to free up spectrum space for low-power FM. It looks good on paper, but back in 2003, religious broadcasters flooded the FCC with several thousand applications for FM translator stations. This great translator station, or this great translator invasion, as it's called, effectively put paper deeds on many open frequencies, which, if the Local Community Radio Act was passed, would still be reserved for an expansion of godcasting networks, as they're called. Until the FCC sorts out the great translator invasion, which it has yet to do, there will be no bounty of spectrum for new low-power FM radio stations, even if Congress were to give the go-ahead for an expansion of low-power FM. One other thing, there is a substantial discriminatory disparity within the FCC's regulations regarding the status of translator stations, which broadcast with up to 250 watts of power and cannot originate local programming, and compare that with LPFM stations, which are capped at 100 watts and are required to be live and local, as they're called, at least for one-third of the broadcast day. Even though translators are more powerful than LPFM stations and provide less local service than an LPFM station ever might, except for those LPFM stations that are being run as de facto translators already, translators are considered a more important service in the eyes of the FCC than are LPFM stations. Until LPFM stations are granted the same regulatory parity and protection from interference as translator stations are, effectively shedded their status as second-class citizens on the FM dial to instruments like translator stations, LPFM advocates are still scooting for crumbs. These, you will note, are primarily technical issues, which are much better resolved at the level of the FCC than in Congress. After all, it was Congress who mucked up LPFM in the first place. Actually, there's pretty serious sign that LPFM wound up buckling under to some pretty shady maneuvers by the broadcast lobby, particularly the National Association of Bastards, broadcasters, as well as, ironically enough, National Public Radio, which actually lobbied against low-power FM because they were afraid that low-power radio stations would bleed away what they thought to be their listeners, particularly people who were interested in non-commercial radio programming. Going back to matters with regards to technical issues over the Local Community Radio Act and low-power FM, Congress first must give the FCC permission to re-expand LPFM out to its original service parameters as first outlined in 1999. Then, second, the FCC needs to rewrite some of its rules regarding the primacy and priority of services provided on the FM band. Third, then, the FCC needs to clean up the great translator invasion mess so a viable, meaningful LPFM window can be opened. You may note that one of these three steps involves Congress, and the Local Community Radio Act is but step one in a long process of bringing LPFM up to its useful protection. Which brings us to the question, will we see more LPFM in 2009? Even if Congress were to somehow magically act expeditiously on this issue, and there are plenty of pressing matters on the plate, the economy, climate change, the war on terror, and so forth, the rubber meets the road at the FCC. And it's anyone's guess just who will constitute the FCC at this stage. We know who the chairman likely will be. Julius Genachowski has been tapped by the Obama administration as the next chair of the FCC. But there are still at least two, possibly three, open seats yet to be decided. There is talk that all of the new commissioners may be nominated and confirmed as a single package. All nominees would actually be brought up and voted on at once. And if that's the case, that may take some time to do. Moreover, LPFM is not at the FCC's own policy radar at the moment. There are plenty of matters involving broadband, net neutrality, and the DTV transition, which actually got a postponement of 4 months to high-power radio television stations until June 12, 2009. And there's still that pesky and powerful broadcast lobby to worry about. DIYmedia.net posts down that there's not going to put, wouldn't likely to be seeing a bona fide expansion of LPFM in 2009. There's a chance that we might be able to see the law passed, But all the twists and turns of this mostly technical tale, as the website continues, can be unkinked by next year. But reform in this particular vein is a slow and incremental process, which is why we must repeatedly go through the process of expressing political will, because each time, a bit more ground gets gained. This may pain some who prefer more radical action, as still a viable option, but this is how the game is played, at least in Washington. There is cause for optimism here. The bill does have a much better chance of actually passing through now than it did in previous years, and it can actually help to build the momentum for helping to set the groundwork for badly needed local community radio in Chicago and across the United States. Those were two media-related monologues recorded on March 7, 2009. Listen to all past episodes of The Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.